This is episode 3 of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast with guests Sean Webb, author of Mind Hacking Happiness, and Bronwyn Williams, foresight lead of FluxTrends.com. Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue. Aloha and welcome to today's episode. This is Tyler Mongan. Today I'm joined by Sean Webb in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Bronwyn Williams in Cape Town, South Africa. Sean is a specialist in human emotional intelligence, artificial emotional intelligence, and algorithms of human emotion. He's the author of Mind Hacking Happiness and currently co-hosts a podcast with two Navy SEALs called Two Seals and a Walrus. Definitely check that out. Bronwyn is the foresight lead and trend analyst for FluxTrends.com, and she's the co-founder of Apollo 42, which develops brands for the future. In today's dialogue, we discuss the role of emotions and expectations in helping leaders shift from being reactive to proactive, why leaders are hungry for change, but also find change difficult, how leaders get trapped focusing on day-to-day operations and cannot find the space to look into futures, how we can use long-term thinking and cognitive reflection to tame emotions of fear when we think about the future, the role of artificial intelligence in decision-making and relationship management, and why the leaders of today might not be the leaders of tomorrow. Let's listen.
All right, so thank you, Sean and Bronwyn, for being here on the show today. Really excited to see where this conversation goes. And as usual, I want to start this podcast by asking the question and addressing it. I'm going to start with Sean, actually. And the question is, from the perspective of your work, how do you answer this question of what does it mean for a leader to be smart or intelligent about the future given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change?
Okay, well, from my perspective as a mind researcher, right, I see leadership a little differently, I think, than a lot of people or some people do in the world, although my position is becoming more in vogue because of science. I believe that, you know, there's been a deficit in leadership overall, and I think good leadership moving into the future has less to do with, you know, some of the market changes or some of the business challenges that they face or mission alterations or whatever it is that they're looking to overcome. I think it has a lot to do with developing the fundamentals connected with emotional intelligence, understanding the human mind and understanding the minds of those on your team to be able to align their intrinsic motivations and get them engaged into whatever it is that you're doing or whatever your goals are. Because, you know, when you're talking about good leadership, you're talking about the ability to understand your own mind, to understand the things that you should be attached to and that you shouldn't be attached to, the things that you're going to drive to achieve, et cetera. But then you're also needing to understand the minds of the individuals on your team, whether or not you're building the proper team for the goals that you have or whether or not you're properly developing the team that you've been handed. And so I think one of the big deficits that we've had just overall as a human race in anything that we do is there's been a huge deficit in leadership in the past. And I think in the future, the changes that need to be made within leadership in general is to develop a higher level of emotional intelligence. You know, the Harvard Business Review called emotional intelligence the essential ingredient to success, and twice as important as being smart and knowing your job, because understanding your own mind, your own limitations, your own strengths, and the minds of the team under you, well, then that kind of gives you everything that you need when you're starting to face those, you know, right tactical decisions or putting people in the right position where they can succeed to tackle the business challenges, the marketing changes, the mission alterations that you have, you know, face as a leader.
Totally agree. And Bronwyn, from your perspective, your work, what does it mean to be a future intelligent leader?
Okay, from my perspective, I do work in the trend consulting space. So I work with businesses quite a lot to help guide them through to the future. And I think that the most successful future-oriented, future-intelligent leaders are leaders that are proactive about the future rather than reactive about the future. And I see this quite a lot, particularly with the South African companies that I work with. A lot of leaders have been put in place almost as farmers, or to sort of milk the cow of the business, rather than as innovators or as visionaries that are able to rally people around a vision as to what's coming next. And leaders that are reacting to changes coming from outside of them rather than being proactive about co-creating the next future that they want to work and live and interact in are definitely not as successful. So for me, it really does come down to people that want to create the next reality as opposed to people who just want to adapt the best they can to something that they feel is out of their control.
I think it's interesting because Sean, with your work, right? This, I think it directly relates to that idea of proactive versus reactive. Can you talk to that?
Sure. I mean, when you're talking about understanding your own human mind, right? You're talking about understanding the attachments that you have. And I think this speaks well to Bronwyn's point that, you know, you have to be very mindful of the things that you have attached to within your own mind and that you've attached to within the minds of your team, the minds of your people. And when you're attaching to old ideas or being reactionary of the things that are existing now, then you might have a blind spot that you need to adjust. And so, you know, one of the big fundamentals of leadership, I believe, is being able to step into your own mind, take a look at the things that you've attached to, take a look at future trends and do your analyses and figure out whether or not you need to take one or two of those things off of your, you know, mind's attachment map, so to speak, and then replace it with, you know, something that's going to be more fruitful for what's coming, the technology changes that are coming or the market changes that are coming, you know, that type of thing. And I think, you know, being able to step into your mind, into that meta awareness space and say, okay, this is the stuff that I've been attached to that's not serving us well. Maybe I need to think about changing that, or altering that, or taking that off my mind map altogether, and then adjusting to something much more beneficial for, you know, the business, the team, yourself, et cetera.
You have any follow-up for that, Bronwyn?
Yes, I would absolutely agree. I think a lot of it's like the difference between sort of hearing and listening and looking and seeing, and the fact that if you want to be a successful leader, you have to be able to really look up and what's happening next rather than just looking at what's currently in front of you, to sort of extend that frame of reference, just extend the length of your gaze beyond the immediate crises or the immediate things that are taking up your attention. So you have that space to look ahead, but to also really see it. So not just look ahead in one direction, to look and scan what's going on in the environment and what's coming from outside the environment and how all those things are going to start interacting. And that requires some space. And that's quite difficult in today's world because we're so busy with the now and we live very much in the instantaneous, eternal now. We never really have enough space to look forward and to plan proactively what our next steps are going to be. And if you're continually in a reactive space, you're obviously not going to be able to design the sort of futures that you really do want to work and live in.
Mm. Oh, yeah. That really speaks to how the body's nervous system works as well. I mean, when you're taking that time to look into the future, right, you're setting your expectations. And there are two variables within your entire nervous system that it uses to create all of your emotional reactions. You know, one of those is your expectation or preference about things. And then that gets measured against your perception of things overall. And so your expectation of things is, you know, basically all the things that you've attached to that you really want to move forward. And they always have to be positive. And then when your perception comes in, that gets measured. And if it's a positive or negative perception, that creates an emotional reaction within your mind to the things that are coming in around you. Well, that negative emotional reaction can literally shut off your prefrontal cortex and allow you to not think as well and to not be able to react as well. And so when you're in that space of that reaction, that limbic system firing, it's turning off your thinking brain, which, you know, 150 years ago was great when we had to react to, you know, snakes or hoses on the ground or whatever it was. And all we needed was energy in our legs to run. Well, now we need to think our way out of our problems. And so if you're not taking that time to look into the future and set expectations, when things come in that don't meet your expectations, that's going to throw you into a tailspin, throw your whole team into a tailspin. And when you can address that stuff, you're going to be a lot better positioned to handle not only the things that come in now, but also the things that are going to be coming in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, with your work, Bronwyn, how receptive are do you find leaders to be about these, like idea of, you know, being more proactive and being more creative and innovative and managing their expectations properly?
I think there's definitely a hunger for it. And I've seen that shift probably over the last 5 years. So maybe 5 years ago, people were a lot more resistant to exploring these kinds of ideas. But right now, there is a hunger for it. But the challenge now is, how do I actually do that? Because as I said, when people are living in a continually reactive world all the time, it's very, very difficult for someone to practically start putting some of these better practices into place to get out of that stress-based anxiety mode of operating. And in times when like our economy is not doing very well at the moment and everyone's stretched to their limits and they're stressed from all different areas in the environment that I live in, from violence and crime and gender-based violence and poor economies and all the rest of it. There's a lot of pressure on people. And I don't know, maybe some of your other guests, maybe one of the two of you have some thoughts as to what leaders can do proactively to step out of the reactionary, stress-based way of existing in a way that's very practical.
Yeah, I think that's the big question. Because I mean, I think part of it too is first realizing that it is a difficult challenge at first. It's something that's not just a change in mindset, but it's actually a change in your physiology and the way your brain starts to wire and fire together. Sean, what do you think on this?
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, plasticity certainly plays a role. The more you practice something, the more your brain changes in form and function to help you do that thing. And so when you're, you know, starting to increase your mindfulness, when you're starting to increase your emotional regulation and your emotional intelligence, your brain literally will change to help you do that on an unconscious level without having to think about it. The more you do it, just like you go outside and you know, you try to learn how to play basketball or shoot a basketball, or you learn how to do crossword puzzles to get better, or you learn how to do, you know, play the piano better. The longer you practice that, the more your brain changes to be able to help you do that more unconsciously. I've been playing this piano for a number of years. I started when I was 7 years old. There are some pieces that I simply have to let go of and let my unconscious muscle memory take over. And if I stop somewhere in the middle of the song, I don't even know where to pick up because it's become so automatic that I just start and my body just does it. I just listen to the music. I just play. Well, you can do that as well on things like emotional regulation. You can do that for your happiness levels. You can do that for your stress reduction levels. And the more things that you practice, such as, you know, mindfulness, meditation and journaling and, you know, breath work and things like that, that can help your physiology. And your physiology is part, you know, your brain is part of your physiology, and how your brain reacts to that will help you in business.
You know, I think like Bron was mentioning too, the real challenge though is like we have just lots of stress in our work environments and our cultures and our daily lives. It makes it even harder to change. Change seems more dangerous at times than just staying, you know, where we're at, even though there's problems where we're at. And Bron, what is, like, I know that you see a lot of the future trends and the need to make these changes. Where do you see like leaders like buying in, and where do you see them really getting like hung up and resistant?
Well, as I said, I think that there's a hunger for the end results, but there's a lot of resistance, particularly in a very sort of male-dominated the corporate environment that we currently work with in my country. But we find that people don't necessarily want to put in the work, and they almost see shifts and to understand that if you want to be a leader, part of your job is actually to look after your mind and get your mindset right. And if that means that meditation is supposed to be a part of your work day, that's the sort of shift we need to be talking about. And it's almost about, we almost kind of need to re-masculate these sort of concepts, which people might find is sort of puts them in a disadvantage in the workplace, because it's showing weakness to admit that you are not strong or that you need help with these things. And to admit that you need to soften your approach to life and to take time for yourself is very difficult for someone who works in a very high-powered, testosterone-driven environment where you're competing with people at a very sort of high-paced, adrenaline-fueled level. So I think that there has to be conversations say that these things are okay, and it is normal to need to find space in order to center yourself, in order to move forward consciously and proactively rather than reactively, always in that sort of war-based mindset. And if we can start shifting business away from being this sort of like aggressors and enemies working against each other all the time, to think rather about ways for people to win-win together, I think that's a much more productive conversation, and particularly when we are in living in times like we are, in times where our entire environment is under stress and we have to find more sustainable ways to do business on every level, on macro levels and on micro levels. So I think it's a very good time to have these conversations, but they're definitely not easy conversations to have because business culture is so fundamentally opposed to these kind of conversations.
Yeah, change is always tough, especially within an organization. The unfortunate reality that we live in is that we live in a universe that is in a constant state of change. Absolutely nothing stays the same from one moment to the next. And that's, ironically, the only thing about the universe that is unchanging is the fact that it's always changing and we always have to react to it. And that trickles down into our lives, into our business world. And, you know, we have to face the challenge that we have physiologically to resist change because, you know, when you're in that brain of yours, your limbic system is always scanning around you for threats. You know, it's looking at, is this idea a threat? Is this person a threat? Is this new product from a competitor a threat? And then, you know, basically you have to then ask a second question, well, a threat to what? And then you have to bring in the definition of the mind's self. And so, okay, well, these are our products, or this is my way of doing things, or this is the way I've always done it, et cetera. And when you change that list of self items that you think you are in your mind, then, you know, not only does the brain resist that because, you know, you're changing the list of things that you've always checked your threats against, which is a little weird, you also then have to go back and check all of your pre-existing threats for a brand new list of stuff. So your mind resists change based on a physiological reaction to that process. And then also there's a physical change in the brain when you unattach to ideas or the ways that you've done things or, you know, the ways that business is done today and you change that, there's a physiological change in your brain. Just like, you know, we're writing memory right now. There's a physiological change in our brain that's creating memory within our hippocampus. And, you know, it's allowing a physical change and we're burning energy and the brain doesn't like to burn energy when it doesn't need to. And so when you're asking a brain to change based on, you know, the way you've been doing things, it doesn't want to do that. So we have to be mindful of that. We have to be very conscious of that and manage that process and make those decisions intelligently.
Yeah, I think also it's interesting, kind of following up on Bronwyn's talk, Sean, like your work too, I mean, about change, but also bringing in the emotional intelligence component. And you're also working with Navy SEALs, right? Who we tend to think of as some of the toughest guys in the world, but they're really embracing these ideas of emotional intelligence and connection and collaboration.
Oh, hugely, hugely. I mean, these guys that I do a podcast with are the biggest proponents of emotional intelligence as a way of understanding your reactions to immediate acute situations, right? Because they have to manage, they've been put into very stressful situations, of course, around the world in very chaotic environments, and they have to manage their moment-to-moment stress and their moment-to-moment reactions so that they don't lose track of their thinking minds, they don't lose their creativity, so they don't lose their ability to react intelligently to the things that are going on around them. And these guys are first in line to say, you guys need to increase your emotional intelligence in every aspect of your life so that, you know, not necessarily when people are firing bullets at you, but when people are firing, you know, business ideas at you, or when your relationship is firing complaints at you about, you know, you haven't taken the trash out or whatever the situation is in your regular everyday life, you need to be able to manage that stuff, manage your stress, keep your prefrontal cortex online and thinking so that you can work your way through these issues and get to your resolution.
It seems like too that they're like with Bronwyn, with your work, this idea of, you know, again, being reactionary, that really puts you into a lot of short-term focus and it makes it really hard to think like long-term. How does this tie into it? This idea of short-term versus long-term thinking?
Well, I think that's why people want to work with people like us, because most people working in business today are trapped in the cycle of today and the urgent rather than focusing on the important. That's why they engage people like ourselves in order to try to shift their thinking. generally what we do when we work with clients is we start with the far futures, with the very speculative ideas, because that's a way to break people out of their current paradigm of thinking. So it becomes a creative exercise, but not a threatening exercise. If you start with futures too close to reality, it becomes more of a strategic game, like how are we going to win? How are we going to lose? What is the immediate threat to us? But when you change the conversations, talk about what could be as opposed to what is likely to happen next, then you can start to at least shift the conversation to get people thinking about the possibility, but the possibility for better, not just the possibility for, you know, surviving the worst case scenario as best as possible within that realm. So I think those conversations are good to have and takes people out of themselves because, as I said, a speculative future a bit further down the line is not threatening. It's something that you can engage with in an abstract manner without being a threat to your current existence or your current position or your current job, which is, of course, the other issue, because when we start talking about change and features in the business place, the reality is that most businesses, most industries, most jobs are going to have to change. And change to an employee or to a salaried CEO or a board member means basically losing your job and having to start something else. So you have to get to those conversations in a bit of a roundabout manner to get people to see that change is positive, even if it does mean starting something entirely new. But the way to do that, as I said, is to start with the end in mind rather than thinking about the immediate threat that can impact on your current reality.
Yeah, managing the fear there in that process is a difficult task to complete sometimes. And so you need the tools to be able to do that when you sit back and you're able to analyze that fear and look at it and understand the two variables that came together to create that fear. That brings down a big black curtain between you and the fear reaction that you're having, the resistance of, you know, whatever it is that's going on around you. And when you can take a cognitive understanding and put it to your emotional processing, your reactive processing, you can actually turn that off. You know, it was Matt Lieberman at UCLA in 2007 that basically defined the name attainment process, where he identified in an fMRI the ability for people to put a cognitive process to an emotional process. And what happened was the emotional processing physically shut off in the brain. It was like a button, a sneeze. You couldn't even stop it from happening. When you put an understanding in your forebrain, your right ventral lateral prefrontal cortex and your medial prefrontal cortex shut off your limbic system and basically said, okay, we're done with the fear. It's just like looking down on the ground, seeing that coiled thing and wondering whether it's a snake or a hose. And then your thinking brain goes, oh, it's a hose. We don't have to be afraid of it. Well, that negative processing stops getting sent from the rear brain to the forebrain at that moment. And then you can start thinking again. You can start operating your life again. Well, the same happens in business. When you can understand your business stresses, when you can understand your resistance to change, when you can understand the stress that's caused by market changes or mission alterations that from above, from executive management or whatever it is, then you can get through those things a lot quicker and be a lot more effective.
Yeah, that name it, tame it strategy, I think, is super interesting because it, like, I could see a team or executive thinking about the future. They start to have an emotional reaction to that future, whatever it is, because it, maybe it's seen as a threat in some way and they don't know what to do about it, right? And so what they usually do is then they say that idea is bad or that future is a bad idea.
Right.
Strategically, of course. But really, it's this emotional reaction that they're having. And if they were just given some tools that said, you know, I'm having this emotional reaction and this emotional reaction is uncertainty. It's this feeling of uncertainty I have, right? Or this feeling of a failure or something. And then just even giving it a name, right? That already starts to calm the emotional system down. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's yeah. And the deeper that you take that understanding, the more on steroids that reaction becomes. So if you just name your emotion like frustration or whatever it is, you can get a reaction as a downregulation in your limbic system that's trying to hijack your brain at that moment. But the more deeply you can understand the two variables that come together to create your emotional reaction to any individual business situation, then you basically crank up the ability to turn down your negative reactivity. And what that does is gives you back your thinking brain, gives you back your creativity, gives back your higher cognitive functions, and then also gives you the ability to look beyond your brain into the brains of your team or the minds of your team to understand exactly what you need to give them in that moment. Because you're not the only one in this situation. You know, you don't exist in a vacuum. When you're talking about leadership, you're talking about the ability to not only manage your reactions, but you got to manage your team's reactions as well. And so you need to have that wherewithal to be able to look within yourself, but also your team at that point and give them the tools that they're going to need to move forward and to get you the results that you need.
It's Great. You follow up on that, Bronwyn?
I think that's a very good point, that whole thing about needing to bring your team along behind you, because as much as it's difficult for leaders to make these shifts, it's even more challenging a lot of times for their teams, particularly when you're dealing with very big organizations with many hierarchical levels. Everyone needs to be bought into the process. And if one layer or one link in that chain is being held back by fear, that whole process can be sabotaged and held back. And I think a lot of the problems come from the top. The leader himself at the top of the pile is the one that doesn't really want to be moving forward. And if you get to that point, then you're obviously not going to be turning the ship in the correct direction anytime soon. So you have to have honest conversations about these things. You can't expect people to be delighted about change. I think most people are naturally adverse to change. There's very few people that like change and new things, that they are out there. They're the minority, not the majority. And particularly, they're the minority in companies that tend to attract salaried workers. By definition, a salaried worker is someone who's looking for stability. They're not the same person who's happy to be a freelancer and take on a bit of extra risk. So I think that leaders have to be extra careful, extra sure that they are passionate about the change and they are comfortable and confident about it, because they're not able to override your own issues. There's no way you're going to be able to guide a whole lot of people who are by their very nature going to be resistant to whatever change it is going forward.
I agree. Well said.
I kind of want to shift this a little bit. So I know both of you also have an interest in like artificial intelligence in some capacity. I think more Bron and more is like how AI can play into decision-making and also, of course, with automation as well. And with Sean's work too, like how emotional intelligence plays into that. So what are your thoughts, Bron, when to start with on AI and decision-making, maybe some differences between those or how they relate?
Okay, to start with, for me, I think the big issue with AI decision-making in a business capacity, when we're talking about making large business decisions based on artificial intelligence inputs, it's a very powerful tool and it can lead to huge efficiencies. But at the same time, it can also lead to quite a lot of homogenization of choice between different industries and between different organizations. And that for me is the business risk of leaning too much on artificial intelligence to guide future choices, and particularly to guide relationships with your supply chain and with your value chain. Because the more relationships you outsource to an algorithm, the more you defer to an algorithm to validate your decisions, to confirm your decisions, to make choices, the less control you have on the outcomes of those choices, because of the other side of the coin is that that means that other people within your supply chain are also increasingly deferring to some sort of artificial intelligence to validate those choices. And the more that happens, the more relationships break down and the less room there is for nuance and for influence of individuals to actually shape the future. So the future for whole industries can very quickly become quite homogenized and quite difficult to get value out of going forward. So I hope I've articulated that in a way that makes sense.
No, yeah, I think it's really interesting, this idea that as we, you know, that the potential is there to automate decisions so much that there's no meaning behind a lot of things we do anymore, right? In a sense, there's no real choices anymore. There's no really relationships anymore.
Exactly. And that's where the value is. And that's where the value comes from. The value comes from the gray areas. So I almost think that there needs to be a defense of imperfect information. As much as perfect information sounds like a noble goal, it doesn't leave much room for human nuance and for exciting features that come out of the less rational decisions that we make. I mean, as we know, as humans, if you've been around here for long enough on planet Earth, the best things that come about in your life tend to be serendipitous and not entirely planned and based on pure logic.
Mm-hmm. Sean, what's your thoughts on all that?
You know, I'm in the world of helping to develop artificial emotional intelligence and some of the modeling connected with that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you talk about data and data analysis, you know, some of the amazing things that occur, like I know a guy from Pakistan who helped Walmart increase sales by double digit percentages by helping them shift the flow of traffic from being clockwise to counterclockwise or something like that. It was something, just one little crazy shift, and wow, people started buying more stuff based on the data. And this guy had also done, he started as a data analysis expert in Pakistan, studying these IEDs and explosive devices and terror attacks and things like that, and started to predict where terror attacks would be and what hospitals needed what resources to address the injuries and things like that, and what mitigation steps could be taken to reduce casualties based on the science of the things that the terrorists were using for explosives and things like that. He's an amazing guy. It's interesting to think that, you know, the future for our race is going to be one where computational analysis can be done on people's feelings, emotions, reactions to things as measured through biometrics and through predictive algorithm processing, and how that's going to play into leadership. You know, there's a very promising and endearing envisioned future for that, but then there's also the scary side of, holy cow, you know, is this computer going to be reading my mind and reading my emotions and creating some type of computational output that will try to be appeasing to my emotional processing? And how weird is that, that, you know, this computational process is going to be reading my mind in some respects? And, you know, there are going to be a lot of positive things that come from that, but we've already seen some of the negative things that could come from that as well, such as with, you know, elections meddling and things like that, where, you know, you create an artificial emotional response in a very targeted audience to get them to take action that you would prefer them to take, whether it's, you know, in the best interest of the greater good or not. You know, these are some things that we really need to think about moving forward. And so it's so interesting, but so kind of, you know, scary as well, that, you know, we need to be very careful in moving forward with our implementation of artificial intelligence, because at a point that an artificial general intelligence gets the ability to emotionally influence a populace. Mm-hmm. I mean, wow. You know, that opens up a whole other Pandora's box that we may not be ready for.
Absolutely. Well, all these technologies, they're double-edged swords. They're neither good nor bad. It's a tool. It's how we decide to use them and where we decide to draw our various respective lines. But artificial intelligence is huge. I mean, it's touching every single field that you can think of. Just talking about what you were saying there with emotional intelligence, I mean, we're already getting to points where there's software companies that will allow employers to monitor the attitude of their staff based on their facial recognition and their emotional sort of algorithms that the facial recognition cameras are able to pick up while you're working at your desk to make sure people are not just doing their job but are actually happy about it. But of course, at the same time, if you speak to quite a few neuroscientists, they're saying that those algorithms are not as accurate as they're being sold to be, which means they're making sort of false diagnoses. And that's the other side of the coin. As much as we should be afraid of, you know, one day an all-powerful singularity-style super intelligence manipulating our various different lives, the other challenge, or the other probably more pressing danger, is attributing all-knowing knowledge and ability to algorithms that are just not as advanced as we've been necessarily led to believe that they are. And that's probably a more immediate threat for many businesses.
Yeah, but the fundamental truth of artificial intelligence is that it learns exponentially quickly. I mean, we fed you know, a number of mammogram readings and results into an artificial intelligence, and in 72 hours, this artificial intelligence became the best diagnostician in the world on mammograms and early detection of breast cancer, based on years of data that had been recorded previously. And so I think, you know, a lot of the hiccups that we have, and I agree that, you know, a lot of the algorithms that we have now are not as accurate, and we're not going to have a lot of the results that people are trying to tout from a marketing perspective and trying to sell their company's services. Those problems can be fixed over a weekend in some certain situations of obtaining the right data or having the right learning algorithm figure its own mistakes out and then automatically changing things to hone in its accuracy and its predictions.
Yeah, so with all this kind of like this change that needs to happen in people, you know, being more emotional intelligent, or really being more self-aware, being less reactive, and at the same time, like, you know, technology coming in here with automation, artificial intelligence, do you, I guess this is for both of you, do you see that the leader of the future is a radically different type of person than we see now? Or is it just similar as it is today, just a different variation? Or I don't know, what are your feelings on that?
From my perspective, I think that the successful leaders of the future are not going to be all that different from the successful leaders of the past, because the leader is someone that's able to rally people around your vision and to get those people to follow you into the next phase of the future. And that's a rare skill. And that's a skill I don't think is going to go out of style anytime soon. But at the same time, the leaders that are being recruited into big corporate positions and boardrooms will probably shift. Because I've certainly seen in the industries that I work at that a lot of boards and leadership roles have been filled out with people with law and accounting backgrounds. And I don't know if those educational background skills are going to be the same sort of skills that are required to lead a corporate organization. Probably going to want someone that has a bit more background in technology, has a bit more background in people as well. So you're actually looking for those two very diverse skills to inspire humans, very valuable humans on the one hand, and also to understand the power and the peril of technology on the other hand. So I think the sort of people recruited into corporate roles are going to shift. But in order to be a leader, you still need to be able to lead people. That hasn't changed. I don't think it's going to change.
So it's kind of like saying that what they do won't change, but maybe how they do it.
Yeah, I would say that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I think that the fundamentals of leadership are going to be the fundamentals of leadership. I think how many people are able to develop those disciplines is certainly going to change. And I think that's going to be a function of our communications technologies. I mean, it's just now we're, what, less than 30 years old on this new internet thing. And we're now just getting to the point where technology and bandwidth is such that, you know, the three of us who might normally in old world never be listened to by anyone can now reach out through the ether to get our messages heard and get the understanding of the science and understanding of the fundamentals of how to be a better leader or how to create a better work environment, how to manage a better team is becoming more available to the folks who need that information. And I think, you know, the leader of yesterday, like Bronwyn said, yeah, that's a tough skill set and a very refined skill set and a very rare skill set. But thanks to the communication technologies that we have today, I think a lot more people are going to learn what they need to be doing versus what they have been doing. Because I do think historically, there's been a huge deficit in leaders and good leaders. And I think the success of the companies a lot have been independent of bad leadership at the top making horrible decisions, but the product or the market or whatever it was simply aligned to allow for the company's success despite bad leadership. I think, you know, an increase in good leaders is going to be the trend for the future because of communication technologies that will allow them to understand what good leadership is, what good mind management is, what good emotional intelligence is, and how to get there from point A to point B if they have any deficit in any portion of their capabilities.
Yeah, so it seems like the just like you're saying, more access to information is going to not only allow more people to be better leaders, but also I think like it may be increasing the standard of leadership across the board as well, because everybody has access to that knowledge and information, and we expect other people to know it too.
Yeah. And, you know, the science is uncovering what good leadership is. And mm-hmm. So, you know, there's going to be a new standard. There's going to be a measurement, just like people, you know, Amazon hires workers based on their ability to walk the floor at a certain speed and get certain amount of packages to a certain amount of, you know, conveyor belts or whatever it is. They measure everything on metrics. And I think leadership is going to be measured in the same fashion moving forward, based on the science that has been uncovered in the last couple of decades about leadership.
Hmm. So I want to wrap up here, and I want to end just by asking you both to kind of share your final thoughts that, you know, from this conversation, you know, what, I guess going back to that initial question, you know, what do leaders need to do to be intelligent about the future? You know, I'll start with Sean.
I think what leaders need to do to be intelligent about the future is to improve the understanding of the human mind, period, right? If you can understand better how your human mind works and how your limitations have presented themselves in the past where you may have not had visibility into that, that's the path of bettering yourself. That's the path of development, self-improvement, right? And then if you can understand the human mind and how it works, all human minds work the same. I mean, it's based on the function of the nervous system. You can pick up a book. I mean, I put one out. You can probably, you know, Google me and find one. But if you understand the function of the human mind, it's based on how the nervous system works. And if you can hack that nervous system, if you can hack how a human mind works in yourself, then you can improve yourself without putting out a lot of effort. And then you can also hack the minds of your teammates to get them in a better space to be able to meet your business goals or have a better management of their emotional reactions to things in the office that'll shut off their prefrontal cortex and not allow them to be the best team member that you can have. And so I think in the future, if you want to be a better leader and you want to be, have a more effective leadership program, learn about the human mind and how it works and how to manage it in yourself and others, and you're going to be golden.
Right. Thanks, Sean. How about you, Bronwyn?
I'll also say that things that leaders need to work on is actually figuring out where they are leading to. So you need to understand where you're going. And I think there's definitely a lack in that today. I think we definitely have a leadership vacuum across the spectrum, whether you're talking about politics or business or really anywhere. We can see that what's going on in the world. We can see that people are looking for leaders. There is a gap, there is a vacuum. And in order to fill that, we need leaders that actually know where they're going, leaders that have an inspiring destination or goal in mind that can rally people behind them in order to move forward. I think people are really looking for leaders today.
Yeah, I like that, how it's one of my perspectives on leadership is, you know, having two kind of main functions. One is governance and compliance. And it's the idea of like maintaining your ship, you know, keeping your ship afloat. And then the second component is having a vision, you know, a goal. Where are we going with the ship, right? So I think both of your sides kind of play into that, like this idea of focusing on your mind as like, let's figure out what your ship is, how it works, and then also having this vision, like Bronwyn's talking about. Love to wrap up with just one word each that just kind of summarizes this for you. So Sean, what's one word for a future intelligent leadership to embrace or embody?
Awareness.
Bronwyn?
I'll go with vision.
Great. Well, I thank you both for being here so much. It's been a pleasure chatting with you and listening to you share your expertise. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tyler. It's been awesome.
Yeah,
great to catch up with you again.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.